Hey everyone, welcome back. You ready to jump into some legal history today?
Always ready.
Awesome. All right. Well, today we're going to be talking about a case that really gets at the heart of the 14th Amendment.
Okay.
And especially how its meaning was kind of, I guess, debated in the early years after it was passed.
Right.
So the case is United States v. Hall. It's from 1871.
Oh, okay.
And it's really cool because it shows how some courts were starting to think about the 14th Amendment as this tool, this really powerful tool to protect civil rights. And they even went so far as to say that it could be used to go after private actors, which is a concept that, got really challenged later on.
Yeah, you're right. The whole scope of federal power when it comes to protecting civil rights has always been kind of this back and forth, right? Like, how far can the federal government go? And Hall is a great example of that, right? It's this snapshot of a time when the 14th Amendment was brand new, like the ink was practically still drying, and courts were trying to figure out, like, okay, what can we actually do with this thing? How far can it reach?
It's like we're stepping back into Reconstruction, right? Like
Exactly.
I can almost hear the creaky floorboards. But in all seriousness, though, it was a time of huge change, but also a really, really sad time
Yeah.
because there was so much violence directed at black citizens who were just trying to exercise their newfound rights.
Oh, absolutely. And that context is super important for understanding Hall.
Totally.
Like, you have to remember that Congress passed the Enforcement Act of 1870 specifically to combat that violence.
Okay.
They were trying to stop these conspiracies that were aimed at depriving people of their constitutional rights.
So Hall basically takes that law and puts it to the test
Yeah, it really does.
because it asks that question, could the federal government actually go after private actors who were violating those rights?
Big question.
Yeah, a huge question. So for those who don't know, the case itself is about, I don't know, I think about them as a group of people trying to silence black voices,
Okay.
preventing them from speaking freely and assembling. And here's where it gets really interesting. They challenged the indictment by using this thing called a demurrer.
A demurrer. Yeah, that's a fun legal
It
term.
is. It is. I'm kind of a nerd for legal
I
terms.
mean, we all are a little bit, right?
I think so.
But a demurrer is basically like saying, even if everything you say is true, it still doesn't mean I committed a crime.
Interesting.
Their argument was all about this idea that before the 14th Amendment, those rights, like free speech and assembly, they weren't specifically protected against like private individuals, you
Well,
know?
right.
It was all about drawing a line between what the state did and what individuals did.
It's tricky because, as we know, the Bill of Rights originally only applied to the federal government.
Exactly.
States could pretty much do whatever they wanted, which often meant they were infringing on individual liberties. So the 14th Amendment, it really changes that whole dynamic. But the question was, how much did it change things?
That's the million-dollar question.
It is. So Hall is really forcing everyone to confront that question. Did the 14th Amendment actually give Congress the power to go after private actors, not just states?
Yeah.
And it's not just an academic question. This has huge implications.
Yeah.
What's fascinating is that the court in Hall, they actually said yes.
They did.
Wait, so the court really said that Congress could go after private actors for violating civil rights?
They did. It's pretty amazing, isn't it?
That's massive. Tell me more about this Judge Woods.
Judge Woods.
His reasoning here, because this sounds pretty radical for the time.
Oh, it was totally radical. Judge Woods came up with this super strong three-part argument.
Okay.
First, he said even rights that aren't specifically listed in the Constitution, things like free speech and assembly,
Right.
he said those were still privileges or immunities of citizens, and the 14th Amendment protected them from state infringement. So it wasn't just about the rights that were written down, it was about a much bigger idea, a broader idea of what fundamental rights are.
So what we're saying is the court was basically saying, hey, the 14th Amendment is bigger than just a list of specific rights. It's about protecting this whole world of liberties, even if they're not explicitly mentioned.
You got it.
Wow.
But wait, there's more.
There's more. Okay, I'm ready.
Woods also argued that Section 5 of the 14th Amendment, that section gave Congress the power to pass laws to enforce those rights.
Okay.
And this is the really crucial part, including laws that went after private individuals if the states weren't doing their job protecting their own citizens.
So let me make sure I'm understanding this correctly. If a state was just ignoring, let's say, a private group that was terrorizing people and violating their rights, Congress could step in and do something about it.
That's exactly it.
Wow, that's a huge shift in how we think about federal power.
Oh, yeah, it was a big deal, and it leads right into Wood's third point, probably his boldest one. He basically said that a state not acting, just doing nothing, could actually be a violation of the 14th Amendment. Yeah, his exact words were, denying includes inaction as well as action.
Woo.
So if a state is just sitting there while people's rights are being trampled, that is a denial of equal protection, and it gives Congress the right to step in.
Okay, that's pretty mind-blowing. So let's apply that to this case. If states weren't doing anything to stop, say, the Ku Klux Klan from terrorizing black citizens, Congress could actually use the Enforcement Act
Right.
to go after those Klan members, even though they weren't part of the state government.
You got it. Hall wasn't just about expanding what the 14th Amendment covered. It was about saying that the federal government had a duty to step up when states were failing to protect those rights, even if it meant going after private actors.
It seems like this is a landmark victory for civil rights, but I have a feeling it's not that simple. This is 1871. We're talking about Reconstruction. There's a ton of resistance to the idea of racial equality. I
Absolutely.
mean, this bold way of looking at the 14th Amendment, it couldn't have just been accepted without any pushback.
Right. You're right to be skeptical. Hall and this big idea of what federal power could be faced a lot of opposition. And honestly, that's a fight that's still going on today, which is what we're going to get into next time.
Well, I can't wait to hear more.
Me
This
too.
is fascinating stuff.
It is. It's a really important part of our history.
So we're back, and I have to say, I'm still thinking about what we talked about in that last segment. Hall really presented this optimistic, hopeful view of the federal government's power to protect civil rights, especially during a time when those rights were facing so many threats. But you hinted that this really expansive interpretation of the 14th Amendment didn't have an easy time, did it?
No, not at all. You've got to remember, we're talking about Reconstruction here. This is a period of massive social and political change. The federal government is trying to reshape the South to really guarantee the rights of black citizens, and they're facing pushback at every turn. Hall was a bold decision, but it was stepping on a lot of toes for sure.
So it wasn't just about legal interpretation. It was about the political climate, the power dynamics, and honestly, just the resistance to any progress toward equality. I bet it was a really intense time to be making such a groundbreaking decision.
Oh, absolutely. And you see that reflected in how Hall's legacy actually plays out. While some people were celebrating it as a victory for civil rights, there was also this backlash building, this movement to really pull back that expanded federal authority. And unfortunately, that pushback really gained traction later on in Supreme Court
I'm
decisions.
guessing this is where the civil rights cases come in. The ones that kind of narrowed the scope of Hall. What was behind that shift? Was it just about legal doctrine, or were there other factors like social and political stuff going on behind the scenes?
Well, it's never just about legal doctrine, is it? There were changes happening on the court, the political winds were shifting, and there was a growing discomfort with the idea of federal intervention in what some people saw as states' rights. The civil rights cases in 1883 are a perfect example of this retrenchment.
Okay, so walk me through this. How did the civil rights cases actually limit that broad federal power that Hall had affirmed? What were the arguments used to justify narrowing it down?
Well, the main argument in the civil rights cases was that the 14th Amendment only gave Congress the power to address actions taken by the state itself, not private individuals. They basically drew this hard line between state action and private conduct. They were saying that Congress couldn't regulate what private individuals did, even if those actions were violating civil rights.
So are you saying that everything Hall had achieved, the idea that Congress could go after private actors like the KKK for terrorizing black citizens, that all got erased?
Well, not completely, but it was definitely a major setback. The focus shifted to proving that there was state action involved, which was a much tougher thing to prove. Now you had to show that a state was intentionally allowing discrimination to happen, not just show that a private group was conspiring to violate rights. It made things a lot harder for people who are seeking protection from the federal government.
It sounds like a loophole, honestly, like a way to avoid the real meaning of the 14th Amendment, even though it was still technically part of the Constitution. Did this narrowing of Hall actually have a real impact on people's lives in the South?
Sadly, it did. It gave Southern states more freedom to put discriminatory policies in place, even if those policies weren't written directly into law. Think about things like black codes, Jim Crow laws, all these ways of taking away people's rights and keeping things segregated that started happening after Reconstruction. The civil rights cases didn't say those practices were okay, but they created a legal system where that kind of discrimination could flourish.
So it's not just some abstract legal debate. This is about people's lives, their ability to vote, to get an education, to live with dignity and without fear. Hall offered this glimpse of hope, this idea that the federal government could be this powerful force for equality, but then that hope was diminished and all these injustices were allowed to continue.
That's a really powerful way to put it. And it highlights why Hall is still relevant today. It reminds us that the fight for civil rights is a constant struggle. Legal victories can be fragile, and we always need to be on guard against attempts to undo the progress that's been made.
It feels like a warning, doesn't it? Showing how quickly things can change, how legal interpretations can be twisted to support certain agendas. But I have to ask, if Hall was pushed aside like this, why are we even talking about it today? What makes it more than just a historical footnote?
That's a great question, and it gets to the heart of why Hall is still important. Even though it's not directly applied in the same way legally, its main ideas, its vision of a strong federal government that's actively involved in protecting civil rights, that didn't go away completely. It became a kind of ideal, a standard to compare other cases to, even if they didn't explicitly mention Hall.
So it was like a source of inspiration, even if it was hidden. Like a spirit in the legal system reminding us of what's possible.
Exactly. And that's what we'll be exploring in part three. We'll look at how Hall, even though it faced setbacks, kept influencing legal thought, even in cases that seemed to move away from its central idea. It's a story of resilience, of how ideas, even when they seem to be defeated, can find new ways to reemerge and shape history.
All right, so we've come a long way with Hall, from its bold vision of federal power to protect civil rights to the later rulings that kind of pulled back on that power. It's been a fascinating journey through history and legal interpretation. But I'm still kind of stuck on this question. If Hall got sidelined like that, why are we even talking about it today? What makes it more than just a cool story from the past?
I get it. It's a good question. And it really gets at the heart of what makes Hall so important, even now. Sure, its direct use in legal cases might have been limited, but its core ideas, that idea of a strong federal government that's actively protecting civil rights, well, those ideas didn't just vanish. They kind of became this benchmark, like this reminder of what a strong interpretation of the 14th Amendment could be.
So you're saying it became this ideal, like a measuring stick for future cases, even if those cases couldn't directly use Hall as a precedent. It's like a ghost in the legal machine, always there reminding us of what's possible.
Exactly. And that's where things get really interesting. You see, even while the Supreme Court was limiting federal power in cases like the civil rights cases, lawyers and activists were finding creative ways to work around those limitations. They were looking for ways to get justice for groups that were being marginalized, and they were doing it within this new legal landscape.
It's like they were playing legal chess, figuring out how to uphold the spirit of Hall, even when the specific rules had changed. Do you have any examples of how this played out in practice? Like, what strategies did they use?
Oh, absolutely. Think about the cases that use the Commerce Clause. Heart of Atlanta Motel is a classic example. The Civil Rights Act of 1964, which banned discrimination in places open to the public, was upheld using the Commerce Clause. Basically, they argued that Congress could regulate commerce between states to stop discrimination. Now, they weren't directly referencing Hall, but you can definitely see echoes of that same focus on stopping states from doing nothing to ensure equal protection.
So they found different legal pathways to get to the same goal. They were adapting to the new rules, but keeping that core idea of a strong federal role in protecting civil rights.
You got it. That's what makes Hall such a great case to study, even all these years later. It shows that legal interpretation isn't fixed. It's always changing. Even cases that look like defeats can plant seeds for future progress. Hall might not have had the final say, but it started a conversation, you know? It laid down a challenge. It gave us a way to think about the power of the federal government when it comes to civil rights.
It's amazing, isn't it? This legal echo that keeps bouncing through history, influencing cases and legal strategies, even when its name isn't mentioned directly. It shows how powerful legal precedent can be. It shapes law and society long after the original case is over.
I think that's one of the big takeaways for our listeners, whether you're law students, practicing lawyers, or just people who are interested in this stuff. Never underestimate the power of legal history, even cases that seem old and dusty. They have important lessons to teach us. They give us insight into how our legal system works, how it's been shaped by society and politics, and how it can be used to fight for justice.
Hall is a great reminder that the fight for civil rights isn't a one-time thing. It's a marathon, not a sprint. There are wins and losses, times of progress, and times when things seem to slide backward. But the fight for equality goes on, and cases like Hall give us a roadmap, and they inspire us to keep going.
Couldn't have said it better myself. And maybe the most important thing Hall gives us is this question. What if its broader interpretation of the 14th Amendment had stuck? How would the story of civil rights in America be different? It makes us imagine a world that's more just, more fair, and it pushes us to think about what role we can play in making that vision a reality.
It's a powerful question, especially now when civil rights are facing new challenges. Hall shows us how much is at stake, how important it is to have a strong federal government that protects individual liberties, and how we need to be constantly on guard to protect the progress we've made.
So true. Hall challenges us, inspires us, and reminds us of the work that still needs to be done to create a more just and equitable world. It's a story that's not finished yet, and we hope our listeners will keep exploring its complexities, its nuances, and how it connects to the problems we face today.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into United States v. Hall. We hope you learned something new about this really important case and how it shaped the fight for civil rights in America. Until next time, keep those legal minds thinking, because history is still being made, and we all have a part to play in shaping the future.